From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on the morning of April 15, 1865. President Abraham Lincoln died from a gunshot wound to the head, a wound he suffered 9 hours earlier at Ford's Theater in Washington, D.C. The president had been surrounded by various physicians and close associates throughout the overnight hours, and when he finally passed away, the room was silent. Perhaps you know the famous line uttered next. Lincoln's Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, broke that silence by saying, "Now he belongs to the angels." Or maybe it was, "Now he belongs to the ages." Or did Stanton say anything at all? History has a funny way of blurring from reality into what we like to imagine. And for decades, the narrative of Stanton's comment has been accepted. But author Walter Starr has something to say about that, and a lot more, about Stanton's role in the Civil War, his career and legacy. Starr's new book is called Stanton, Lincoln's War Secretary. It explores the life and career of Edwin Stanton, who is sometimes invoked as the man second most responsible for the Union winning the Civil War. One of Starr's previous books is about William Henry Seward, Lincoln's Secretary of State. Starr is coming to the Seward House this coming Sunday, and it's timely. The recent remarks from General John Kelly have a lot of Americans thinking about the Civil War and its causes. So Walter Starr is back with us. He's on the line with us, the author of the new book, Stanton, Lincoln's War Secretary. Congratulations on another fine work here, Walter. Thanks for taking the time for the program.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
And Jeff Ludwig is here with us in studio. He is the Director of Education for the Seward House Museum in Auburn. Welcome back to you, Jeff.
Thanks, Evan. It's a pleasure to be back.
And on Sunday, this coming Sunday, I said he's coming to the Seward House. He is. And then he's coming to a place right next to the Seward House. So why don't you tell our listeners what is coming up this Sunday?
This Sunday at 4 o'clock, the Seward House is pleased to welcome Walter back to town. He's going to give a talk just for us on Seward and Stanton, friends, rivals, colleagues, and we're hoping for a good turnout. So we're actually using Westminster Presbyterian Church right behind the Seward House. You can still park in our parking lot. You can come and just walk in or give us a call at 315-252-1283 to purchase a ticket online. We'll have plenty of copies of Walter's book for you to get signed. Westminster's a very beautiful church. It's got some great Seward connections. The Seward family gave the Tiffany stained glass windows in the church. So a great venue. We've got the whole thing ready for Walter. And we're excited to have him come in and be a part of this big conversation.
4 p.m. Sunday.
That's right. Thank you, Evan. Yes, 4 o'clock on Sunday.
4 o'clock on this coming Sunday. And let me just start there and let's get this out of the way, Walter, because I've heard that story of Stanton saying now he belongs to the ages or the angels. And in various portraits of that scene, there are so many people stuffed into that room that your book points out, you know, that room couldn't have held everybody at the same time. So history becomes a little bit of fiction over time. What has your scholarship pointed to what was actually said, if anything, by Edwin Stanton or anybody in those grim moments after Abraham Lincoln died?
I don't think he said anything.
You're such a buzzkill. You are a buzzkill, Walter.
I know. It's sad because this is the one quotation. If you look in Bartlett's Familiar Quotations, this is his one quotation, the one thing he's known for. But, you know, those words first appear 25 years later when Lincoln's private secretaries, John Hay and John Nicolay, publish a book about a 10-volume history of Lincoln's life. And if you think about something, Evan, that happened 25 years ago in your life, well, do you remember exactly what happened on that night?
25 hours ago is hard enough.
Right. And there are a lot of accounts that were published right after Lincoln's death, detailed accounts, you know, including by one of Stanton's clerks who was in the room. And what that clerk and others say is that Lincoln's minister said a prayer in which everyone in the room joined, and then there was just sort of silence, and people kind of walked out one by one. And I think, you know, if Stanton had said something, his clerk would have, and, you know, his clerk wrote a letter describing this in great detail just a couple days after the event. And there's nothing about Stanton saying anything about ages or angels. He talked about how, you know, even strong men such as Stanton were sobbing.
Hmm. Well, obviously it was an awful scene, and Lincoln and Stanton had a fascinating relationship. I will tell our listeners, the last time Walter was on this program, 2014, his amazing, and that's not a word I like to say often, but his amazing book on Seward was the subject, and I had a wonderful opportunity to consume all 500 or 600 pages of it. I highly recommend it. I mean, if you love the Doris Kearns Goodwin sort of genre, the David McCullough genre, Walter Starr is right there with it, and the book on Seward is just fabulous. Stanton, I've had in my hands for a much shorter time, and I am not through it all. So, so to some degree, Walter, I'm gonna be a bit of a not complete interviewer, but I'm gonna do my best here. Though I look forward to pouring through the rest of it here. Tell us why you wanted to look at Stanton to begin with.
Well, after Seward, I was sort of casting around, what am I going to do next? What am I going to do next? And when I sent my agent, you know, a kind of one-page version of Stanton, it was like that old cartoon in which Lucy says to Linus, "That's it!" And Linus is sort of thrown back from his piano by the force of her her conviction, you know, because in one sense, it's a similar book, you know, both lawyers, both political figures, both Lincoln cabinet members. But in another sense, he's very different. You know, Seward is such a genial, pleasant person. And Stanton is a much darker, you know, he's called, not to his face, but he's called in the newspapers and, you know, a tyrant, a dictator, an autocrat. And so it's, you know, it's sort of another cut through the Civil War with a very different person as the center.
It was 5 years ago that the film Lincoln came out, and maybe listeners had a chance to see that movie, Daniel Day-Lewis as Abraham Lincoln, but it was Bruce McGill who played Edwin Stanton, and I've got a clip that I know Walter Starr actually thinks is pretty good, is probably pretty close to what it was like in the telegraph office. Now, Stanton spent a lot of time in the telegraph office, and in this scene, you're going to hear sort of the buzz of war, the buzz of Stanton talking to others there in the office about what's happening in various places. And then you're going to hear the voice of Daniel Day-Lewis as Lincoln cut them off with the story and Stanton's classic reaction to the president is going to waste our time with another story. Let's listen to the clip.
They've taken 17,000 shells since yesterday. I want to hear Fort Fisher is ours and Wilmington has fallen. Send another damn cable. The problem's their commander. Waiting. He engineered the fortress himself. The damn thing's his child. He'll defend it till his every last man is gone. He is not
coming out, rat. You old rat!
That's what Ethan Allen called out to the commander of Fort Ticonderoga in 1776. Come on out, you old rat! Of course, there are only 40-odd redcoats at Ticonderoga, but there is one Ethan Allen story that I'm very partial to.
No, you're going to tell a story. I don't believe that I can bear to listen to another one of your stories right now. I need the B&O side yard scheduled for Alexandria. I asked for them this morning.
I love Lincoln. I love Lincoln laughing at Stanton as he storms out of the room saying, I'm not going to do another one of your stories. Walter, pretty good on that? You think that was pretty close?
I think it's pretty close. You know, there's not just one source. There are dozens of sources talking about Stanton's rudeness and how he was rude. And indeed, Seward himself saying that, you know, everyone from the president on down to the porter has suffered from Stanton's rudeness. And so, yeah, I think that's and the fact that he's prepared to turn away from the president in order to get some details about the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad Yard, I think is also great because he understood that you've won the war by mastering the details.
Such a good scene. So that is Bruce McGill, who, again, he's not the main character in Lincoln, but did you like the choice in the film? If our listeners are going to go back and watch Lincoln, did you like the choice for Stanton?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I thought, and if we're talking about movies, it's a somewhat older movie, but The Conspirator by Robert Redford, which deals with the conspiracy to assassinate Lincoln and the trial afterwards, has Kevin Kline playing Stanton. Now, physically, Kline is way too tall and thin and good-looking to be Stanton.
Yeah.
But but the emotion, you know, starting really at the same point where you started it, with the night of the assassination and how Stanton comes in and takes control. There's a wonderful scene in that movie showing Stanton on the night of the assassination.
Well, you talk about an unprepared host. I did not know that Kevin Kline ever played Edwin Stanton.
Kline plays Edwin Stanton in the movie The Conspirator. And even if you don't, you know, aren't particularly interested in the Mary Surratt, it's worth seeing Kevin Kline take on Edwin Stanton.
Okay, see, there's one to mark down. What did you think of David Strathairn as Seward?
I just the cigar and the glass of wine and the sort of urbane. I loved him. I thought it was great. I mean, the only modest problem was that they gave Thaddeus Stevens such wonderful lines and such a wonderful actor that David Strathairn wasn't in the running for the best supporting character.
That was Tommy Lee Jones, right?
Yeah.
Tommy Lee Jones as Thaddeus Stevens. Jeff Ludwig, what did you think of Strathairn as Seward?
I really loved it, down to the sort of flamboyant outfit. It really, I think, captured nicely Seward and suggests some of the contrast between Seward and Stanton. If you think about that film and the scenes that he shares with Lincoln, Daniel Day-Lewis, it's such a different dynamic. Seward is sort of fretting and fussing about Lincoln, and he's not being deflected with humor, but Lincoln sort of rolling his eyes, but keeping Seward along as Seward just says, oh, disaster, catastrophe, every time Lincoln disagrees with him, but wanting that closeness. And I think it captures sort of the different styles and different energies.
Listeners, our guest this hour is Jeff. You're hearing Jeff Ludwig, the director of education for the Seward House Museum in Auburn, and Walter Starr, the author of the new book Stanton, Lincoln's War Secretary, is on the line with us. It was his book Seward, Lincoln's Indispensable Man, that brought him to the program back in 2014. And what I love about historical works like this are that in your education and mine, you've learned about the Civil War, you've learned about the Revolutionary War, you've learned all kinds of historical events, but you rarely get it in a way that reads like it's an amazing fiction, even though it is real. I think of David McCullough's 1776, one of my favorite books, and I would put Seward at the very top of that list, and that's why I can't wait to get through the rest of Stanton, because I think that when people like Walter Starr dig through years upon years worth of letters, correspondence, historical records, newspaper accounts, and then can put it together in this way, it takes a special gift, and Walter Starr has that. So it's great fun, and we're going to return to the question of Stanton, Seward, sort of team of rivals, what Walter's going to talk about on Sunday. But unfortunately, right now, I'd like to kind of divert our attention to recent comments we've heard about the Civil War, because here we are in 2017, and the Civil War is sort of back in the headlines. It was General John Kelly, who's the White House Chief of Staff, who made some comments on Laura Ingraham's Fox News show about the Civil War and about Robert E. Lee. So first, I want to listen to those comments that sparked it. Then I want to read some other comments that have been written about it, and we're going to get Walter Starr's take on all of this. This is John Kelly talking about Robert E. Lee and the causes of the Civil War.
Robert E. Lee was an honorable man. He was a man that gave up his country to fight for his state, which in 150 years ago was more important than country. It was always loyalty to state first back in those days. Now it's different today. But the lack of an ability to compromise led to the Civil War. And men and women of good faith on both sides made their stand.
That's John Kelly, White House Chief of Staff, on Robert E. Lee and the Civil War. Here's the Washington Times headline, not the Washington Post, the Washington Times headline. John Kelly is right. Robert E. Lee was honorable. Cheryl Chumley, online opinion editor for the Washington Times, writes, quote, Kelly's quite right. Lee may have been divisive, not to mention contradictory, but what battlefield leader isn't? The fact his family owned slaves, the fact he was ambiguous at best on slavery, now casts Lee in an evil light, end quote. And in the New York Post, here's Ralph Peters under the headline, Kelly is right about Robert E. Lee, quote, while slavery brought us to fratricidal war, that doesn't mean everyone who wore a Confederate uniform fought for slavery. Quite the contrary, rare was the rebel soldier who owned a slave. As usual, the rich often stayed home. So let's judge the dead as we're admonished to judge the living as individuals. As a student of the Civil War since childhood, it astonished me when the media reacted to Kelly's statement that Robert E. Lee was an honorable man as if Kelly had praised Pol Pot. Robert E. Lee was, in fact, a man of flawless honor in his times, end quote. All right, Walter Starr, respond to that. What do you make of that?
Well, how to put it, within his, you know, limits, if you will, Lee was honorable. But I was struck by, you know, here's a man who graduated from West Point, served in the, for the, you know, United States government for years and years, and then a war breaks out and he resigns his commission. And not every Virginian did. I mean, Winfield Scott, among others, the senior military officer, he was from Virginia. He remained with the Federal Army. So, you know, Lee had a choice and chose the side with slaves, and I think he can be faulted for that. And this notion, I mean, that people didn't attempt a compromise on the eve of the Civil War. I mean, I have a whole chapter in the Seward book about Seward's efforts to try to find some form of compromise, and Stanton as well, who served as Attorney General during that period, was keen to see if there was some compromise that could keep the country together. So it was not for lack of trying during that secession winter that the country fell apart.
All right, so a couple of points I want to work through with both of our guests on this point here. Sometimes in politics, when we talk about if you vote for somebody, you're voting for X, and kind of a transitive property of politics. For example, you know, people will say, well, if you voted for Donald Trump, then you must be XYZ because Trump said XYZ. I'm not sure, or forget Donald Trump, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, whatever. I'm not sure that's always fair. But I'm also not sure that you could say that a Confederate soldier, many Confederate soldiers, didn't fight for slavery, because the cause of that war was slavery. So therefore, if you are fighting as a Confederate soldier, I do think you can say you were fighting for slavery. Walter, do you disagree?
Certainly, maybe in the case of, you know, low-level people, they might get a pass. But Lee is at a level, he does not get a pass. He owns slaves, and he understands that slavery is at the heart of this. And so I generally agree with you that Lee does not get a pass for siding with the Confederacy.
Okay. Jeff Ludwig, what do you think?
When I first heard the quote and read the full transcript, I was struck, obviously, by the comments about Lee, and we can get into that. But I think the thing that I took more umbrage at as a historian was the notion, and Walter's already touched on it, that somehow it was a failure of compromise, that it's the causal root of the Civil War. And Walter's right. I just sat in the coffee shop across the street before coming in today, rereading that chapter and watching Seward frantically try to save the Union through compromise. He's preaching moderation in triumph after the election of 1860. But more to the point, I think if you look at U.S. history from 1787 to 1861, it's a nonstop series of compromises with the South, from the Three Fifths Compromise, the Constitution, the Missouri Compromise, the Compromise of 1850, Kansas, Nebraska, and in 1861, during a four-month-long secession winter, because Lincoln wouldn't be sworn until March, not January, 1861, Seward's sort of the center of a bit of a power vacuum in Washington, maybe trying to broker a Compromise of 1861, as Walter's putting it, putting on the table a 13th Amendment, before we know our 13th Amendment, following the Emancipation Proclamation, Seward's a big part in, that would have written into the Constitution the sanctity of slavery where it existed. And Seward even is willing to put the further expansion. He and Lincoln had always said that where they drew the line with slavery was not where it currently was, but territorial growth to the West, that perhaps New Mexico could be added to the Union as a slave state. And that was part of the old calculus, a balance of power calculus in Washington that slave states and free states would enter together, extending the life of slavery, giving them representation in Washington. So Seward's really all about compromise during this period specifically, and Lincoln is as well. It seems like if you read Walter's chapter, it's 40 pages long of all these efforts at forestalling disunion.
That's why I think I'm going to send John Kelly a copy of Walter Starr's Seward, because I think he needs to read it, Walter. And I would let me ask you about compromise here. So, because I think some of our listeners will hear, oh, Seward was willing to compromise, therefore Seward endorsed or, you know, sort of proliferated slavery. And I know that argument was had in Seward's. Tell me, it's been a few years since I read the book, Walter, so let's see how good of a student I am here. Seward's own wife was more radical than he was in terms of abolition, pushed him harder, was occasionally disappointed where he stood. Seward was a pragmatist who assumed that slavery was on its way out eventually. It's not going to last. It's a terrible thing. This country is not going to keep it. And so knowing that, keeping the Union together was vital because slavery does not, we were not long for slavery, even if it wasn't tomorrow for abolition. Is that a sort of a broad speaking?
Yes, and specifically in this secession winter when he gives his famous speech in January and his wife up in Auburn reads the speech, I mean, she writes him a scathing letter saying, you know, you've abandoned all your principles, and he writes back, not to worry, not to worry. So, I mean, Seward is so actively pursuing compromise that it's causing, you know, difficulties in his own household. Now, you know, none of it, you know, ultimately it doesn't come to pass. There is no compromise of 1861. We instead wind up in civil war. But I do feel that General Kelly is doing a disservice to that generation and the really, you know, all-out efforts of people, actually, and they're Southerners as well. And mind you, there are some diehard Southerners who are very happy to see a civil war, but there are also, particularly in places like Virginia, the border states, there are many Southerners who are keen. Former President Tyler convenes a whole convention in Washington to pursue the topic of compromise.
So for our, you know, for listeners who want to say, well, if Seward was willing to compromise at all on slavery, then, you know, that you want to cast sort of a moral judgment against him. I understand the urge, and everyone's going to make their own judgment of history. I remember when Andrew Sullivan, a conservative blogger who, you know, was probably one of the most well-read political writers in this country in the last two decades, who's also gay, was writing about marriage equality. He said to fellow gay Americans, give Barack Obama time. That he thought in Barack Obama's heart, who Sullivan had supported, he said, I would be willing to bet privately he would tell you, of course, I'm for marriage equality. But he would probably also tell you pragmatically, we have to figure out a way to do this because we can't jam this thing through tomorrow. It will be met with opposition. It will make things harder. And we will find a way to get this thing done in the course of time, even if it's not tomorrow. Now, some gay Americans probably would have said, well, Obama came out, you know, against marriage equality at one point, so you have to be for it. But now Obama and his presidency are looked pretty favorably from the LGBTQ community as advancing rights and equality, even though it wasn't overnight. And I wonder if Seward is sort of the same way. I mean, Walter, I mean, do you view Seward in that way that you can understand the urgency that his wife feels, and you can understand the way some Americans now might look back at him and say, how could you ever compromise on that? But do you view him in the same kind of light that says, this was a man who did not support slavery, but he understood some of the machinations to get things done?
Yes. I mean, looking at that winter, I think that, you know, he did what I think he should have in terms of, you know, going as far as he could and maybe a little farther than he should have, at least on an exploratory basis, to see if a compromise could be reached and a war which he and others knew would be terrible, although perhaps they didn't know how terrible it would be.
Jeff, some other thoughts before we turn to Stanton's view on enslaved Americans and his sort of his disposition. Some other thoughts on Seward there.
Yes, please. So I think it comes down to a question of looking at an evolving radicalism in Seward. here in Rochester, while Seward is in Washington, January 1861, putting compromises like this on the table, Frederick Douglass is throwing his hands up at all the compromising that Seward, and he thinks maybe by proxy Lincoln, are willing to sign up for, is ludicrous. This is what Seward's getting from home, too, in Auburn. His wife, Frances, I have the quote flagged in Walter's book. After reading his speech, she writes to him, "Eloquent as your speech was, it fails to meet the entire approval of those who love you best." She feared that her husband was becoming the next Daniel Webster. "Compromise based on the idea that the preservation of the Union is more important than the liberty of nearly 4 million human beings cannot be right." And you almost see him weighing two really difficult things. Is his highest priority these 4 million enslaved peoples? And he's certainly against slavery. During this time, his house is a stop on the Underground Railroad. During this time, Harriet Tubman is living half a mile away on Seward property. He's actively involved in trying to erode the strength of slavery, and maybe also thinking, if not quite in terms of how big a bloodbath over 600,000 dead soldiers are going to come, of just how many lives are at stake here, lives enslaved and lives to be lost on these battlefields. And that is sort of a really difficult moral choice to have to make.
So Walter Starr, the author of Stanton, Lincoln's War Secretary, let's talk about his war secretary. You have you wrote extensively about how Stanton wanted freed slaves and black soldiers treated, whether as prisoners or not. Tell us about that.
Well, pretty much from the moment he becomes Secretary of War in early 1862, Stanton is pressing Lincoln, who's initially reluctant, to enlist blacks into the army as soldiers. Partly that's because Stanton needs more soldiers, but it's also because he has an understanding of the way in which being a soldier, being in that blue Union Army uniform and having the Union rifle, is going to change the lives of the black soldiers. And he also feels a moral responsibility because at the time he arrives in the War Office, there are already a fair number of former slaves or fugitive slaves or contrabands, you know, there are various terms applied to them, living in camps at the edge of the army camps in places like Fort Monroe. I mean, basically anywhere that the Union Army is in the South, there are going to be former slaves near at hand. And he feels a responsibility for those people, not just the men whom he'd like to list in the army, but the women and children. And he presses for and ultimately obtains legislation to create something called the Freedmen's Bureau within the War Department to look after, you know, both the most basic things, you know, food and housing, but also education, you know, the beginnings really of federal civil rights.
Let's get our only break of the hour because I'm late for a break, and we're going to come back with Walter Starr, the author of Stanton, Lincoln's War Secretary, also the author of Seward, Lincoln's Indispensable Man, and that relationship between Seward and Stanton, part of that, well, team of rivals or the people closest to Abraham Lincoln. We're going to explore that with Walter Starr when he comes to the Seward House Museum for an event right next door to the Seward House Museum this coming Sunday. We'll get you set on that and talk much more with the author after this break on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, progressive journalist Chris Hedges joins us. We'll talk about advocacy journalism, activism, and covering the Trump administration. In our second hour, U.S. Army Captain Sam Brown is in Rochester sharing his story. He was responding to an ambush patrol in Afghanistan in 2008 when he was set on fire when his vehicle hit a bomb. He now uses his experience to help wounded soldiers across the country. Talk to you Thursday.
This is WXXI AM Rochester, WRUR FM and HD Rochester, WEOS FM and HD Geneva, and WXXI FM HD2 Rochester.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Community Design Center, hosting the 7th annual Reshaping Rochester Awards Luncheon, honoring people and projects working to advance the region, Thursday, November 16th at Temple Brith Kodesh. Tickets online at cdcrochester.org.
It's easy to look at the headlines to get a sense of the news.
9 senators rejected that Senate version of the bill.
Venezuela was paralyzed by strikes and protests.
This missile can actually travel much farther than...
NPR digs into the center of the story to help you really understand not just what's happening, but why. Stand with the facts. Listen every day.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Walter Starr's book on Edwin Stanton, Lincoln's War Secretary, is detailed in the same way that his book on Seward was. And there is a cartoon that you include in your book, among many, by the way, political cartoons of the day. This one called Breaking That Backbone. McClellan and Halleck try to break the backbone of rebellion, but Lincoln, in the cartoon, is telling Stanton that the tool they need to break the backbone of the rebellion is the axe that Lincoln carries over his shoulder. And the axe is actually the Emancipation Proclamation. How did Stanton feel about that, Walter?
Stanton was an advocate of the Emancipation Proclamation. He, when it was first discussed in July, pushed Lincoln to do it right away. Again, perhaps he's a little closer to this issue because of the blacks living in the army camps, or on the edges of the army camps. So he was in favor of the Emancipation Proclamation. If it had been up to him, it would have been issued a bit earlier than the final version on the 1st of January, 1863.
So what was the relationship between Seward and Stanton? I mean, that's a complex question that could get its own many hours. But let's start with that and tell us what you're going to be talking about on Sunday when you come to Auburn at 4 p.m. for the event titled Seward and Stanton, Friends, Rivals, and Colleagues, Walter.
Well, although they have kind of parallel careers in politics and law before the war, they don't really know one another until this period we've talked about, the secession winter, when Stanton is in the cabinet of James Buchanan, the outgoing president, and Seward is kind of Lincoln's representative in Washington. It's known that Seward's going to become the Secretary of State. And as a way of communicating with the new administration, Stanton starts to talk with Seward, and Seward shares the information that he's getting from Stanton with Lincoln. Then Buchanan leaves, Lincoln arrives, Seward becomes Secretary of State. Again, not much relation for several months, and lo and behold, when Lincoln needs a new war secretary, Seward is one of those, maybe the most important person, who says to Lincoln, the man you need is that Stanton, diligent, hardworking, determined, and even though he's a Democrat, he's the man you need.
Why did Lincoln put up with him when he was so often obstreperous and rude? Was it because he was so competent?
Because he was so competent, because he, Lincoln was a man blessed with, patience. A little bit of rudeness was neither here nor there. He was much more focused, as were Seward and Stanton, on winning the war.
I want to talk about a number of other themes that Walter explores in the book. I want to let Jeff Ludwig tell us again, 4 p.m. this coming Sunday, and it's don't go to the Seward House and Museum, or if you do, you'll probably see where the event is because it's right near next door, right?
Right. Auburn's not that big. 33 yes. South Street, that's the Seward House, and right behind us on William Street is Westminster Presbyterian Church. We have a website, sewardhouse.org. You can read more about the event there. We're going to have plenty of copies of both of Walter's Seward biography and the great new Stanton biography. He's going to give the talk at Westminster Presbyterian at 4 and then stick around, talk to people, sign copies of books. So if you're enjoying this conversation and you want to hear more from Walter and you want to pick up these great books, this is a great opportunity to do that.
This is what happens, Walter, when I'm trying to plow through a 500-page book in about a day and a half, and I don't have really time to absorb and make the notes that I want to. So I recall at least at one point a discussion about someone who Stanton had been willing to have imprisoned for months at a time without any formal charges, and I wonder how you view Stanton's record when it comes to civil liberties and how that echoes today.
Well, unfortunately, there was not merely one person. There were many such people, and they were and some of them, mind you, should have been imprisoned. There were Southern spies operating in the North. There were people who tried to tear up railroad tracks or plant bombs, but some of them were newspaper editors who, you know, published anti-Lincoln editorials and found themselves arrested, and then when they tried to get out of prisons, found themselves languishing there for weeks on end. So his record on civil liberties is not very good. I perhaps should just stop there. It's not very good. One point to bear in mind, among other talks I'm giving over the next couple of weeks, I'm going to be talking about Stanton and Lincoln. This is not just Stanton's record on civil liberties. This is, to some extent, Lincoln's record, and we need to understand that. Although Lincoln's not the guy putting the handcuffs on, he has the ability at any point to spring these people from prison, and he doesn't.
And he's aware of what's going on. So when you say these are Lincoln's record, this is Lincoln's record too on civil liberties, flesh it out a little bit more on why you say that.
Well, to take another arrest, a former member of Congress, prominent, actually becomes a candidate for governor of Ohio, Clement Vallandigham, is arrested. They beat down the doors of his house in Dayton, Ohio at midnight one night. And there, that wasn't ordered from Washington. That was the local army commander who did that. But of course, the moment it happened, it was in all the newspapers. So Lincoln reads the newspapers. He couldn't pick up the phone, but he could go to the War Department telegraph office and send a telegram saying, release Vallandigham. Do not bring charges against him. He didn't. He allowed the man to be tried by a military commission, sentenced to spend the rest of the war in prison, and then Lincoln doesn't overturn the sentence. He merely changes the punishment to being exiled to the Confederacy. So, this is not just Stanton and the generals running amok during the Civil War. This is, to some extent, Lincoln himself putting, peace and quiet and the war effort ahead of people's right to be free of midnight arrest and imprisonment.
You also tell a story in the book that I think Rochesterians will find pretty remarkable about Stanton and Frederick Douglass, and how Frederick Douglass nearly ended up with the post. And it seems that, I don't know if we have direct evidence of this, but Stanton got a little bit of cold feet. What happened there?
I think they actually both get cold feet. So Douglass comes to Washington, and he meets with both Stanton and Lincoln, and he's quite impressed with Stanton. He, first of all, that Stanton takes an hour of his busy day to talk with Douglass. And at this point, the effort to recruit blacks into the Union Army is well underway, and Stanton says to Douglass, we need you to be part of the recruiting effort. And Douglass says, well, look, in my private way, I'm already doing that. I'm out there giving speeches, encouraging young black men to enlist. And Stanton says, no, I want you to work for me. And then there's a period of sort of silence, and Douglass sends a couple letters and gets letters from a couple of Stanton's aides. And I think both men kind of get cold feet. Stanton realizes that if he really gives an army commission to this Douglass, who after all is not merely black but radical, that there's going to be a huge hullabaloo. And Douglass, who's the most prominent black American at the time, realizes that he's more effective as an independent speaker and editor than he would be as an army general. So looked briefly like Frederick Douglass joining the army as a general does not come to pass.
But Seward's wife, was it Franny?
Francis.
Francis Seward would have told Stanton, Jeff, just get this guy in the post there. Make that statement. Wouldn't Francis Seward have told Stanton that, Jeff Ludwig?
Yes, I think she probably would have. She probably would have written to her husband to see what he could do to make it happen. They knew Douglass. Seward was a financial backer of the North Star newspaper, and he'd met with Douglass in Washington, too. I think Frances would have, if she'd been in the room, would have been definitely in her husband's ear, urging him, as she often did, to do what it took to take that more radical, harder choice.
Frances Seward would have torn a streak through Twitter. And if there had been Twitter in the time of the Civil War here, and my guess is Seward would have told Stanton, Walter Starr, that that his decision on Douglas and a military commission was probably pragmatic. What do you think?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's where he would have been. It would have been, you know, look, you can get the black troops in other ways. We don't need a huge fight about making. I mean, after all, you know, Frederick Douglass has no military experience, although in the Civil War, that's not a complete obstacle. Lots of political figures get generals' stars without a lot of military experience.
I want to read a passage from Walter's book, and he talked a little bit about the Freedmen's Bureau, but I think this dovetails with the discussion on Frederick Douglass, because even if Edwin Stanton, as Secretary of War, had cold feet, in the way that Douglass might have as well, about that kind of a position for a man like Frederick Douglass. He did fight for equality in a number of ways here. And I don't think, I'll ask Walter in a second, if he thinks there's any credence to anybody who would say, well, are you whitewashing history now? I don't think so. I'm just going to read from Walter's book. Quote, Stanton devoted several paragraphs in his year-end report to the topic of black soldiers. He noted that there were now 50,000 black soldiers and predicted that that number would rapidly increase as our armies advance into the rebel states. Many people had believed or pretended to believe that slaves would not make good soldiers, that they would lack courage and could not be subjected to military discipline. Black soldiers had now proved themselves, Stanton wrote, at Milliken's Bend, at Port Hudson, at Fort Wagner. He urged Congress to end the unfair salary difference so that the federal government should pay black soldiers the same amount as whites. Soldiers of the Union, fighting under its banner and exposing their lives to uphold the government, colored troops are entitled to enjoy its justness and beneficence. End quote. So, Walter, in total, Stanton's record on equality, on, you know, how we should handle civil rights, what's the overall look at his record, and how does this relate to that?
I think his record is pretty good on this. You know, the black soldiers, the Freedmen's Bureau, and then after the war, as you know, the chaotic conditions in the South, and he's getting these telegrams of blacks being, you know, raped and murdered. He insists that the Union Army has to stay to maintain law and order, to protect the blacks. And that's the disagreement with President Andrew Johnson that leads to Johnson's attempt to remove Stanton and then our first impeachment of a president.
That's where I was going next here. It was the first impeachment. I was surprised, I guess. I mean, I don't know my history all that well. This is the first impeachment, and tell again, Walter, it was specifically over what?
It's not the first impeachment per se. There are lower level people impeached, but it is the first impeachment of a president.
Of a president.
And the specifics were that Johnson attempted to remove Stanton from being Secretary of War. And you might say, well, that's his right. He's the president. He can fire anybody. But Congress had tied Johnson's hands with something called the Tenure of Office Act, which basically said that if someone's appointment required Senate consent, then the president couldn't remove that person without Senate consent. And so he was impeached for violations of the Tenure of Office Act, impeachment being the first stage, namely kind of the accusation by the House of Representatives, and then the action moved to the United States Senate, where they held a full-blown trial, weeks and weeks, to assess whether Johnson should be convicted and removed from office.
He was impeached but not removed, correct?
Correct. Impeached but not removed. How to put it, whether you're a Trump supporter or a Trump opponent, I think, you know, maybe reading my Seward book, maybe reading my Stanton book, reading up on impeachment might not be a bad idea for Americans right now to begin,
Are you making a prediction?
I'm A little while back, the Wall Street Journal asked me if I'd write one of their five books columns, and I think they wanted a column about the Civil War, and I said, well, what about impeachment? And they said, oh, yes. So I spent quite a while finding five good books on impeachment that I think should perhaps be on people's reading list. I'll at least predict this. We're going to talk about impeachment for the next few years. Whether it's going to happen, I don't know, but we're going to talk about it for sure.
It's important to probably point out, the technical nature of this, but it's true. When we say someone was impeached, it does not mean removal. And sometimes we talk about impeachment as if it means removal from office. Right, Walter?
Correct. That's right. The word impeachment is sometimes used loosely as if it meant removal. So Johnson was impeached, that is, charged with crimes by the House of Representatives, but not removed. Ditto Richard Nixon. There was the committee of the House Judiciary, passed a resolution to impeach him, and he actually resigned before the vote came in the full House of Representatives. Clinton impeached by the House of Representatives, but not convicted and removed by the Senate. We do have some interesting history. Worth reading, even if it has no reference to the president.
If it doesn't, we've got a few minutes left. I want to ask Jeff Ludwig. Jeff mentioned earlier, as the director of education for the Seward House Museum, he mentioned earlier off air that you like to think about a very different world, what the world was like when President Lincoln might walk, down the street with one or two people alongside him over to the telegraph office, and what those moments must have been like. Tell me how you imagine those scenes, Jeff.
I can tell you, having this March had the privilege of going to St. James Church, John's Church in Washington, where Lincoln would often go to the pew, which is still marked, that in the Lincoln film, they recorded for the sound of that movie, actors walking across those floorboards, and he would often go from the telegraph office to that church. I've heard what it sounds like, because the man who did it for the movie did it for me, and it's a sound you never really forget. And I think many times we'd hear also the sound of footfall on wet grass as Lincoln would cut across the White House lawn to visit Seward and Lafayette Square many nights to sit up and talk about the war and their worries. I did want to say, if it's okay, the Seward House is nonpartisan, nonprofit, and we're the house of a Whig and Republican family. But if you are interested in learning from an educational standpoint about impeachment, we've been talking a lot about that this year in context of Seward's Folly. You were kind enough to have me on the show in the spring with a different historian talking about the sesquicentennial of the Alaska Purchase, and a lot of the complications that evolve around this a purchase of Alaska from Russia, the Russian-American colony. It gets called an icebox, a polar bear garden, later Seward's Folly, is tangled up in the fact that Seward is waiting for the House Appropriations Committee to authorize payment to Russia in the backdrop of an impeachment scandal. And there are great cartoons that we could point to from cartoonists regarding Seward and this controversy, but a lot of the heavy burden Seward would carry about Alaska is also about this impeachment proceeding. And we've been talking about that a lot this year. We have our Alaska exhibit up for two more months. So if anybody hasn't been to the museum in a while and you want to see it and learn about Alaska and a little bit about impeachment, you can visit us Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 5.
Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 5. How often do you have visitors who are first-timers these days, Jeff?
Every day somebody will come in and say it's their first time. Many of them are from Central New York, the Finger Lakes, Western New York, even Auburn. But every day somebody's seeing it for the first time.
And Walter, how many times for you?
Oh, gosh, I've been to the Seward House maybe half a dozen times. You could say in a way that I wrote the Seward book because of the Seward House. I was sort of thinking about a Seward book, and I went there to the house, and it was as if Seward himself was going to come around the corner with a cigar and say, come into this room and meet some folks. I mean, it was just such a wonderful experience, and of course the people there at the house were so eager for there to be a new Seward biography that by the time I left that day, I think I had gone from thinking about writing the book to determined to write the book.
You're writing the book, and I'm glad you did. Let me grab Jim in Rochester, one phone call, and we got to keep it as tight as we can. Go ahead, Jim. Thanks for calling.
Yes, I want to make a comment about Robert E. Lee. I know a lot's been made of him in Whitby Kelly comments, but he went to the United States Military Academy, West Point. He took an oath and a pledge to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States of America. He made war on the Constitution. Some of the greatest generals in the history of warfare, Dwight Eisenhower, David Petraeus, Swarkoff from the first Gulf War, they never took up arms against the Constitution. So that's a study in contrast. But I will say this, because of some of his military maneuvers, they are teaching his military maneuvers and what not to do, because he got defeated in the Battle of Petersburg. And also, he made some terrible mistakes in the Battle of Gettysburg. So all you got to do is go down Route 15 and go through some of the battle parts. But he was a traitor because he took up arms against the Constitution of the United States. That's what I'm trying to say.
All right. That's Sam in Rochester. Thank you, Sam. Walter, some thoughts on that. Go ahead.
I basically agree with that. Although there are some moments when Robert E. Lee saves us. I mean, if you think about what he could have done in April of 1865, when he could have told his men, you know, scatter, fight a guerrilla war, and he didn't. And after the war, he is really right at the forefront of those saying, we are Americans now, and we have to stop fighting this civil war, and we have to reunite. Stanton, Seward, Robert E. Lee, you know, all of these people live long, complex lives. You can't sum them up in one moment.
I'm with you, but I also don't want to overcomplicate matters on what side General Lee chose. Walter Starr is the author of Stanton, and the book is Lincoln's War Secretary. It's out now. You can get it now. Can get it this weekend?
That's
Jeff
right.
Ludwig, yes?
We have a couple boxes full.
So you can meet Walter Starr. You got about 10 seconds to tell us what's coming up Sunday.
This Sunday, November 12th, 4 o'clock, Westminster Presbyterian Church. You just walk on in. Tickets will be available at the door. Or go to our website, sewardhouse.org, learn more.
That's in Auburn, you should mention.
Auburn, New York, yes, right down the road from here.
Auburn, New York. Jeff Ludwig is the education director for the Seward House Museum. Always good, Jeff. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan.
Walter Starr, another remarkable work with Stanton. Thank you for taking the time for the program, Walter, and keep cranking them out. You got an open slot here. We love talking about this stuff. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Always
Bye.
Good. Walter Starr. Stanton, Lincoln's War Secretary. Thanks to John Andrus, the engineer, Audrey Sample, the intern, Megan Max, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a great afternoon, and we're back with you Thursday on member-supported public radio.